And we are back with episode 251 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I promise this episode will not end with us threatened by a helicopter gunship and then going away for 4 months.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and eye patches are cool.
And this is Bronstone from Australia, and there's far easier ways to add a rogue to your group if you're really that desperate to round out the party.
And we are obviously going to be talking about The Walking Dead, Haven, and Revolution. But first, Edmund, if you could please.
We will talk about absolutely anything that might have happened on these episodes, so be forewarned, you will most likely be spoiled. But we've waited a while before we do that, so hopefully you've all had a chance to catch up.
Yes, hopefully so, because yes, we will definitely be spoiling the first episode we're going to be talking about, and that would be The Walking Dead. And here's the promo.
Next Sunday, on the mid-season finale of The Walking Dead.
What about Glenn and the girl?
The longer they're here, the more chance Andrew will find out.
He's my brother, ain't gonna
crack what he did. I need you.
Come on! You have to leave her!
We think she's leading us into a trap.
All right, and full finale, all right. And that would be The Walking Dead, Season 3, Episode 8, Made to Suffer. New threats to the prison survivors arise while the Woodbury population readies for a new danger. Wow, that was vague.
Almost misleading, really.
Really, yeah. Almost like they weren't at all the same thing. All right, well, why don't we go ahead and start with Bronstum. You write the reviews for this, so give us the high-level beat-by-beat for this one.
The high-level beat-by-beat. It was... I'm trying to think of how to phrase it. It was definitely a really awesome episode, and a good way to sort of round out this first half of the season and have a big... Well, no, not necessarily a big conclusion. I guess that's kind of my mixed thoughts in the episode, is that while I thought it was really, really awesome and it was packed with really, really good things, it didn't strike me as very mid-season finale-ish. And if you're going to be off the air for a little while, it seems like you'd want to end on a big note. And I think there were some big notes in the episode, but it just lacked that big kind of conclusion finale sort of feel.
Well, I think I like leaving it as a setup as opposed to, you know, like, as you said, some sort of big close. I'm sort of anxious to see, you know, how they're going to go about this, you know, the two groups literally battling it out. And I think the tension of that is actually a little bit more intriguing to me than having to wonder who survived the bloodbath or something along those lines. So I thought it ended in a nice place.
There's definitely some tension and stuff like that in that regard, and I'm looking forward to seeing the second half of the season. Don't get me wrong; it's just the stuff happening in the episode. It was on some of the more recent episodes, as opposed to the big deaths and the big kind of emotional punch. And this episode lacked a lot of that sort of thing. It was very plot heavy, and there wasn't a lot in the way of character beats. I felt though there were some really good ones. There was the big stuff with Michonne and the governor and Andrea really looks like it's going to kick the governor's villainy up a notch. And there was the little moments with Rick that I thought were interesting, even if they kind of came out of nowhere. But my favorite character arc in this episode was the stuff with Carl. And I mean, let's backtrack a year. Do you think anyone was really likely to say something like that about Carl?
I'm sure there are people who would have predicted that the big character arc for Carl was actually him staying in the damn house. I mean, it's still a joke, even though he's been pretty good this year.
It's still a joke. Yeah, we've moved beyond that, but it's still funny.
Yes. I agree with you. That was a really surprising turn.
Yeah, they folded the introduction of Tyrese really well into the thing. Tyrese is a character from the comics who... I'd not been sure if they were going to bring that character in or not, and I'm glad they did, because he wound up being a really good presence in the comics. But they introduced Tyrese in that and his little group of survivors in that opening thing, and Tyrese is clearly he's the leader of that group. He's the alpha male sort of thing. So then when that group and Carl run across each other, you get this really, like, it's it's mostly uncommented on, but basically you get Tyrese and Carl sizing each other up as equals. Because in that, in those two scenarios, they are both the leader alpha males of their respective groups. And it just, that's the dynamic straight away. That's how they look at one another and how they respect one another. And it's sort of most blatant in that last scene with Tyrese and Carl, where he's just like, the man's made his things and we're safe here, so we're going to, be cool and we're going to play it like he wants. And it was just, it shows just how far this, that character has come in the last, the last eight episodes alone. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how much further they go with it, especially once Rick is back with the back in the prison with most of the people, and you've got a few different characters who could step up and be the leader in any given situation. And just the idea of Carl as being able to be an equal to his father is, that's interesting. That's really awesome.
Well, I have to say, I think they're writing him well, but as far as the acting goes, Carl's, coming across so stiff at first, you want to sort of equate it like the kids in Shock, of course, with everything that's going on. But it's just, I'm having a hard time pulling myself out. The kid just seems to be walking through the motions. You see, the actor who's playing Rick, really, like, you can feel his pain, his frustration, his sadness and everything like that. And the kid's just sort of like, come with me, wait here. I can't trust you. Danger, Will Robinson.
But I would ask the question, Rick is kind of wearing his grief and his shell-shocked attitude on his sleeve. Could this just be the way that Carl is reacting to the way things are going? Because if I think back to that scene after Laurie was taken out, Rick is, screaming and all of his anguish is just releasing out of his body. And Carl is just standing there stiff as a board, cold as a stone the whole time. And I'm wondering if that's just that this is an expression of how this turn of events and everything that's happening is just really robbing him of his emotional health at this point. I mean, I'm saying that not having seen the way that he was before, and I can't really make a valid comparison there, but I do feel like in the last few episodes he's been a lot more stoic than he's been in the past.
Yeah, I would go back to that that shot at the end of Killer Within, where just at the very end when Rick finds out that Laurie's dead, and you've got Carl in the foreground and Rick in the background, and Rick is just losing his stuff. And Carl he's gone all stoic, and it's like a really deliberate performance kind of thing. He's just like really fixing his gaze, and he's holding himself really still, like really bottled up. And that's the impression that I've had in the episode since then, is that he's keeping himself in check and, not flipping his biscuit the way that Rick tends to.
I hadn't thought of it from that aspect before. I'll have to go back and rewatch and see. I understand your point. It was pulling me out of the show a bit.
Mm-hmm. Edmund, how about you? What were your reactions from this one?
Yeah, on the Carl thing. I've gotten the definite sense. Yeah, that's his way of processing it, more to the point, not really processing it. I mean, I think between having to take out his mom and then seeing Rick's reaction. It was this overwhelming thing, and his way of dealing with it is to just try and be, super kid, basically. That plays right into the situation in this episode where he is the one left behind, basically, and then having to step up. And I'm not discounting. I mean, there's also, with child actors, that's probably the direction they're giving him, and it's not necessarily going to be the most nuanced performance of it, but I agree that I think it makes sense within the character. And I was actually intrigued with the way they handled sort of this first confrontation, because there was a sort of expectation of going into it with the way they're structuring the seasons now with, these mid-season finales. And so, you sort of think it's going to be, something huge, but then again, it wound up to me feeling more like, a skirmish. I mean, this is the first little confrontation of what's probably going to be, an extended battle. So, you know, that, you know, no, this wasn't going to be something decisive. You know, this is them going in, you know, I mean, it was a infiltrate and retrieve mission. Certainly it helped establish what we were talking about in the previous episode that, you know, yeah, you know, team prison is definitely a little more organized and used to doing this stuff. And, you know,
no, they're the chain gang.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, some of the holes in Woodbury's defenses were definitely exposed, but, you know, between the ease with which they did it, and then certainly, you know, I mean, that, you know, rather amazing confrontation between Michonne and the governor and the aftermath of that, you know, we can certainly expect the governor to ramp things up when they come back. And once we discover exactly how Merle and Daryl get out of this situation, since we know they are. So,
yeah, and that was probably my one disappointment with the way that this ended, because I think that maybe we're discounting a little bit the point of the episode, and maybe it wasn't this huge, big cliffhanger, but what I saw this as was a definitive shift in the character of the governor, where the first half of the season we're seeing him as maybe somewhat sinister, but relatively okay, given the circumstances of the zombie apocalypse.
He's more of a dark parallel to Rick.
Right, where now he is absolutely just insane. And he's really much, much closer to the character in the comic after what has happened. So I see this as being a turning point in the storyline, definitely. I mean, it makes sense for it to break here, because after this, the status quo is now very different. You know, Woodbury's not just going to be sitting there doing their own thing. They're going to be coming after them. Very likely it's going to be because it's going to be prompted, at least at first, by however Merle and Daryl get out of this. And I could even see this as being a situation where the governor and Merle talked about this up front, and this is going to be how they get somebody into the chain gang, by having Merle, quote-unquote, escape with Daryl. And then that's going to be their infiltrator, and that's how they're going to try and get information on how things are going over at the prison. But regardless,
you think the governor still has that much together that Merle's the plant? A plant?
I really do think so, because there was a distinct something missing between when Merle said, "Just tell me what you want me to do," or whatever, in the governor's house. And then it seemed like the governor gave him this look like, okay, I know exactly what I want you to do. And then to go from that to what happened in the arena seemed like a bit of an abrupt switch. I mean, it is just a theory, but at the same time, I feel like, how else are they going to get out of there? But at the same time, I can see the governor using this situation as a way to whip up support for an armed assault against somebody else, where before it was only him and his little lieutenants going out and doing things, and then he'd tell his little lies to the rest of the community. Now he wants the whole community behind him. But that's just a theory. So that was a little disappointing to me, unless it turns out to be a little bit part of something bigger, and that's kind of the way that I usually wind up looking at these types of things. But I guess the only other thing that really got confused me slightly, or at least felt a little bit less impressive than it could have been, was the basis for the whole Michonne governor scene. Now, of course, you know, readers of the comics know that there is a big, huge, whopping reason why Michonne would want to do something like that. But it was pretty much absent from the show. And I think that we made some comments back in the past episodes when we were discussing the show that it didn't seem like Michonne had a whole lot of concrete reasons to be so distrustful of the governor, other than she might be a pretty good judge of character, but even then, she seemed to be hostile towards him very quickly for no real good reason. And it doesn't seem like his influence on Andrea would be remotely enough for her to want to have this kind of violent need for revenge to take him out, you know, and to do all this stuff. It just felt to me like that was not as well built up as it could have been. Am I making sense with that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, her motivations weren't well defined.
Right.
I agree with you that the motivations, yeah, not so well defined, but then they get into the scene and that sequence, and I think that sequence worked really, really well, both the Michonne discovering Penny and the big fight, and then that exit with, like, you know, Mexican standoff with Andrew. I think those things all worked really, really well. For one thing, you had it continues to present this image of Michonne as someone who isn't completely gone. Like, has this, like, I mean, the reason why she always gets her face bitten off by Penny is because she thinks that this is a child, like, and tries to help it. And it was sad to see that backfire on her. Then, of course, it leads to the big fight with the governor that was brutal and bloody and just everything you'd expect of The Walking Dead. with all those snapping heads rolling around on the floor for good measure.
Yes, that was quite an impressive fight, and I thought that they did a nice job of making the stabbing of the eye just as gory as one would expect, though perhaps not as graphic as the comic wound up being. But
I also like some of the unstated things, like obviously the whole Andrea Michonne confrontation. You know, almost nothing was said, but at the same time, volumes were. And even as Michonne saw the heads coming out of the aquariums, it doesn't take much. It takes a lot to rattle this woman, and I could have the sense that, oh, geez, he's more screwed up than I even thought, which was a nice little sort of non-verbal, you know, expression for her. So I really liked those two scenes, even though they weren't dialogue heavy by any means.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was a little. I guess maybe that also added to my disappointment slightly, because when Andrea comes in and is looking at her like, "Are you insane? You know, why did you do this? Why did you do this?" I felt like Michonne could have just kind of gestured towards the aquariums, like, "Have you seen this at all?" It's, you know, or say he was keeping his daughter, the zombie daughter, in his closet, chained up. See, she's right over there. It seemed like she wasn't willing to really go that far, but at the same time, they've been playing her character as so just laconic, to say the least. It's maybe they just didn't want to have her just launch into an explanation. I mean, when she wound up having to practically beg Rick to let her continue fighting with them, it's almost like she was struggling just to get that many words out. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can kind of understand that part, but she was hanging out with Andrea for 9 months. You'd think that they'd have more to say to each other at that point. But again, you know, I can't really argue too much how things panned out from there. And certainly I have to imagine that Andrea is now going to have a lot of things to think about now that she's seen Daryl and knows exactly who it was that was attacking Woodbury. So, yeah, I think that it was a fairly successful mid-season finale. Definitely got a lot of the moved a lot of things forward. I do definitely agree that the introduction of Tyrese and how they did it with Carl got a lot of mileage out of that, and I think that it will be important for when Rick comes back to hear about the fact that Carl took charge in that manner. Although he probably won't be too happy that Carl was roaming around in the tombs by himself.
I was about to say that I thought prison was more secure than that. So basically, all the walkers can get all the way up through that back hallway, and then they stop.
Apparently, they managed to secure off a large area, and he had deliberately gone outside the safe zone. That's how I took it, at least.
Right. I mean, when you saw Tyrese and his group come up to that part of the prison, the building was wide open.
Yeah.
So the logic there, well, I guess, is that they had managed to cordon off the areas where they couldn't secure it. And as long as you didn't go over there, you were okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the impression I got.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it just seemed like the zombies would sort of pile up there after a while, constantly trying to get to them. And we saw virtually no one there until Tyrese started coming, you know, came through that area. It just seemed a bit of a plot hole to me.
I wonder, I'm if they don't see anybody for a while, would they just continue to be there? Or would they just wander back off? You know, unlike the fence where there's constantly, they see people walking around, so they're going to be drawn to the fence.
I don't know. Maybe the governor's done some psychological profiling as well. So.
Maybe. All right. Well, Bronze Thumb, you gave this one a 9 out of 10.
I did.
Mm-hmm.
Just despite that sort of lack of... that lack of punch was really the only problem I had with the episode, and that's, I mean, very much a subjective thing. As mm-hmm. we've proved over the course of this conversation.
Mm-hmm. And Gary, how about you? What would you give this?
I'm sort of wavering between an 8 and a 9. I had some slight issues with it, but it was a generally solid episode. And well, not that it's necessarily completely hopeful, but it was nice to see the our whole crew working together to, you know, to free
Glenn and Maggie.
Yeah, to free Glenn and Maggie. I thought it was sort of nice how well they worked together, how effective they were in this against Woodbury. So I think I will give it a 9, actually.
Okay. How about you, Edmund?
I'm fine with a 9, too.
And okay. I will round us out with another 9. And that gives us, this is definitely one of the highest scored episodes of this first half of the third season. And the third season, up to this point, is coming in at an average of 8.6. So definitely way up at the top.
Sounds about right.
Yeah,
they're hitting those kind of marks. So.
Yeah, let's hope that the second half of the season is just as good. All right, well, we are going to go ahead then and switch gears to another show that has been going through its third season, and that would be Haven. And we have a couple episodes to get through here because we were backlogged from the Thanksgiving holiday here in the States. But first, here's the first promo for the first episode.
On Sci-Fi's original Friday.
Duke is trapped in 1955.
We can change our fate.
Whatever they're doing is screwing up Haven as we know it.
There are people here that think you're a threat.
Think about the future.
All right, and Bronze Thumb, if you could do the recap for us.
Righty, just as soon as my computer stops being funny. All right, Haven Season 3, Episode 9, Sarah. One of the Troubled sends Duke back in time to Haven in the 1950s, and Audrey and Nathan must rescue their friend before he changes the past and eliminates their present. When Nathan gets sent back as well, Audrey finds herself trapped in a new reality where Reverend Driscoll's men control the town and hunt the Trouble. So, it's a time travel episode, and personally I kind of like those, because for reasons that I've never really been aware of. Never really defined, I'm quite fond of time travel as a storytelling concept, and I thought they employed it well in a lot of ways, because it gave them a chance to go back and explore bits of the town's history that had been alluded to or only semi-explained since the back half of Season 2. Things like the Crocker family curse and the past lives and everything. So I quite enjoyed those aspects of it. I thought the stuff with Duke and Nathan going back in time, like those two characters have a really, really fun dynamic when you put them in a room together. Just the super stoic and the super jokey one. So that was good value. And I liked how they took the opportunity in the present day stuff to futz. They didn't spend a lot of time there, which I'm glad, because of course the story is what's happening back in time, but they brought back, you know, a recurring character from earlier in the show, and I was glad for that. Like, they used that opportunity well. On the downside, I really don't think the actress did a good job of playing Sarah. Like, was I the only one who just felt that was quite off?
It felt very strange. To be honest, I thought the entire episode felt strange. But definitely that was off-putting in a lot of ways. And I had a real problem with the way that the story played out, and then everything that was happening in the quote unquote present in the new timeline, I really had no idea what was going on most of the time. Only towards the end did I get a really good kind of picture of it, but I still didn't feel like they did a lot to flesh that out so that it was a meaningful difference. Like when they wound up having her and Nathan's father, and I guess who was it that was with them at the time, but when they were, you know, held at gunpoint, up to that point I was really wondering, like, what's with all the tension here? Like, they didn't really explain a lot of what was going on, which has always been one of the things that Haven has had as a little bit of their drawback, is that they have a tendency to be very close to their vest when it comes to explaining things. But in this case, I felt like that there were things that were just left way too vague. Well, meanwhile, they were playing this whole time travel thing, and it felt like it really just wasn't gelling, at least not for me. And some part of that was that I couldn't really get a read on the character of Sarah at all. And they probably could have done a lot more to connect the tissue between the things they've said about Sarah in the past and what was going on in this episode. I think that would have helped. Anyway, Gary, what did you think of this episode?
I thought the whole future timeline change thing was almost really unnecessary to the story, and I'm surprised they tacked it on, honestly. It just seems so extraneous that we could have just sort of hovered back in the past and said, you know, somebody wasn't supposed to die or something like that, or just Nathan's transition alone might have been enough to, you know which direction history needed to be steered, or at least what would happen. I'm not going to take quite as much offense, or well, that might not be the right word. I thought the actress did a decent job as Sarah. I thought that she's still supposed to be somewhat like Audrey, but not entirely. And some of the speech patterns were slightly different and almost awkward, but still enough to see that there was some slight distance. And I enjoyed it. I didn't think it was necessarily just her with a wig, even though, of course, we know that's what it was. I also liked Sarah's interaction with Nathan, which is, you know, somewhat different from Audrey, or at least at the moment is. And I guess it'll propel us further down their relationship should they have their talk. Hopefully not over a beer at some place. But anyway, I enjoyed the time travel part of it, just like Bronstam did. The current time, as you said, I think the mistake was that things kept changing. If it had made like a single change, but there were, as best I can understand it, there were multiple changes happening in the current time zone.
Yeah, pretty much every time we cut back to Audrey, something had changed. And
I think that's where they screwed up. Yeah.
The problem is that that whole in the future, I mean, basically it was they were trying to do two things. One, it was an excuse to bring back the chief. And two, they wanted to illustrate that there were some stakes to all the time traveling. That, we can't futz up too much. We have to make sure things go okay or else it'll be bad. And those a storytelling kind of narrative thing that they felt they needed and then something that they wanted to do wound up being the excuse for the stuff that happened in the present day. That was just really not an important part of the episode.
And you know, if that's what they wanted to do and they wanted to do that really well, maybe they could have taken that two-parter that they did not so long ago. I think it was right before this episode, which really felt like it didn't need to be two-part episode, and made this the two-part episode, because then they could have gotten into it more, and it would have maybe made more sense.
That would have been a far better idea.
Yes.
A better use of resources, definitely.
Because I got to say, Gary, you were mentioning that you really liked the Sarah-Nathan interactions, but to me, that felt rushed, that I didn't see them being so
I just
cozy
figured
so
Sarah was outgoing. That's
well, okay, but even for that time, that was...
you can make that assumption, but the stuff that was happening with Nathan really deserved a lot more time to play out, because for him, this is a kind of... like, it is a kind of wish fulfillment. It's a chance for him to be with Audrey without having to be with the baggage
of
being with Audrey. And there were hints of that, and it wasn't played out nearly as much as it deserved to be.
Oh, yeah, like the scene on the beach when he went walking back to her. You saw him like, oh, what the hell?
went back.
Yeah, no, that definitely some
in case we don't meet again.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Duke and all of his stuff, I think that exploring his family history could have been done over a longer time period as well. And it would have been a lot more affecting when he found that there was no way to change history.
Well, then that's, you know, and that was another big flaw I had. Okay, everything unfolded the way it should. So why did it change on the other end in the first place?
But yeah, I mean, that's probably another reason why they probably shouldn't have done that, because it was just muddying the water even more. I know that they had a lot of fun making this episode. This was probably their favorite episode, as they discussed at New York Comic Con. But I feel like it was the novelty of doing the time travel thing that was why they liked it. And I don't know that the final product really matches the expectation that they kind of gave me, because while I liked it in theory, in practice, I think it just wasn't what it could have been or should have been.
A lot of good ideas, but a lot of the elements of the presentation fell apart.
Right. And I don't know how much of that was the director. It didn't feel like a regular episode of Haven in a lot of ways, but it also didn't establish a firm tone out in the when they went to that other time period. It's not like they did much to establish that was that time period. It didn't feel authentically different.
And what was with all the military personnel? This is 55. Are there really that many army and sailors all around at the same time? It seemed like a cheap prop way to get, you know, period costumes out there.
I don't know, but it what it reminded me of in a lot of ways was all those 50s flashbacks on Eureka, where they did a really good job of showing.
I thought
that
those were
40s
flashbacks.
40s, 50s, whatever. But the point being is that back then, when they went back in time, you definitely got the feeling that that's what had happened. Everything about the world looked like it came out of that time period. In this case, it looked like it was just them playing a different role in the exact same spot. It wasn't as convincing as it could have been. Like I said, maybe if they did it as a two-part episode, maybe they would have had the scope and the time and the budget to make it work a little bit better. But yeah, coming off of the two-parter and coming into this and considering what they were hinting was going to happen in this episode, I felt like there were a lot of missed opportunities. Not my favorite, let's put it that way. So, Bronston, what would you give it?
It's not my favorite either, and there were a lot of problems with the presentation, but I think there were also, like, I did like a lot of the ideas, and it was a good way to do a lot of this sort of backstory and information, and the hints of what could have been really, really excellent were in themselves quite good, so I'm going to go a 7.
Okay. How about you, Gary?
Yeah, I'm right there with Bronson. Oddly enough, I'm agreeing with everyone tonight. No, I'm going to go with a 7 as well. It had a lot of potentially good points, and I don't want to downplay those too much, even though there were a lot of flaws too. I have to say that even some of the confusions of the current timeline aside, I did kind of enjoy watching this. It didn't turn me off.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to disagree with the two of you and call this one a 6. I think there was something that was missing there. I'm not sure if it was the writing or if it was the direction, but I think that there was something that just wasn't clicking, and it took the rest of it down. It was probably a combination of the writing and the direction, but there we are. All right, well, that being the case, let's go ahead and move on to our second episode of Haven that we were to talk about, and here is the promo.
On Sci-Fi's Original Friday...
I hate my guts!
Her secret...
Something isn't right about this.
...is the key...
Let her go!
...to Haven's destiny.
You said you didn't know anything.
Tell me the truth!
All right, and Gary, if you could...
Absolutely. We're talking about Season 3, Episode 10, Burned. Audrey and Nathan help a troubled girl who the guard wants for their own purposes. When Jordan reveals her true colors, the officers learn the truth about the barn and Audrey's destiny, and who the real bolt gun killer really is. Dum, dum, dum.
Sorta,
but...
Yeah, I was going to say that.
We figured out who it wasn't.
Yes, which I thought was a nice touch. I gotta say, for all that I was complaining about the previous episode, this was a nice bounce back in the right direction, at least from my point of view. Talk about changing the entire direction of the season without actually being contradictory in the process. I say that because this is probably one of those plot points. Everything that Jordan says about the guard and their attitude towards Audrey, that's something that we probably should have figured out a long time ago. Because they have said pretty much from the start that when the troubles come, things go to hell in Haven, and she shows up. And then at some point, she goes away, and the troubles go away too. So yeah, I would expect there's a whole lot of people that are involved with the troubles who would want her gone. And they're going to facilitate her leaving. So yeah, I think that it made a lot of sense, and I just really enjoyed the way that this played out.
It was a brilliant example of how to integrate the episodic story with the overarching story of, you know, by introducing this troubled person and going through all the things with them. And I thought, you know, by the standards of Haven's A-plots, you know, trouble of the week sort of thing, it was done really, really well. But then it was integrated so well with all of this exposition about, you know, the guard and how to get rid of the troubles and the bolt gun killer and all that kind of stuff. And it was just everything gelled together so well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's this episode's a really good example of how they've really gone past the power of the week, and they're able to take, you know, introduce is still in a sense a power of the week, but they're able to pull it into the storyline so well that it's not like glaring out at you like, oh, you know, they could have tacked anything into here. It fits and, you know, advances the story, which is really, really a nice thing to see, because as this series began, we're always concerned about this one, you know, power of the week. And then they switched it over to, you know, sort of the deeper, dark plot with the guard and, you know, destiny and things of this nature. And now they're sort of merging them back in again together, and they're doing it better than I expected them to.
This feels this is what most of season two was like.
Yes.
This kind of balance, I think, and the, you know, season three up to this point has skewed the balance way more towards any given episode will skew way too much in one direction or another.
It's been a lot less consistent than the second season was. That's for sure. So yeah, I think that I just think that everything in this episode was hitting all the cylinders. I mean, we had the stuff going on with the troubled girl, which even though it was obvious that there was more to the story, it didn't really click for me until right before it did for the characters exactly what was going on. Although I guess, you know, they did kind of reveal it earlier than that, but you get my idea here. That I thought that was a smart way to do things. I thought that it also made sense of their ability to kind of throw out a lot of exposition without going completely awry with how it was going to be played out in terms of the revelations and everything else. I think it all made sense for it to happen the way that it did. Let's put it that way.
Mm.
Any other thoughts for this episode? I mean, we've talked a lot more about the other one, but this one, for all that it had so much going on, it was just so good from start to finish. I don't know that we really need to say very much more.
Well, we didn't need to pick it apart the way the other one did. We didn't have the flaws that, you know, that we like to dig into so much. So
yeah, that's true.
It I loved the reveal about the bolt gun killer, because that's been. I mean, it's been such an up and down thing over the course of the season. I mean, I thought the bolt gun killer was introduced as a really effective villain, and then the reveal that it was Tommy came out of the blue, and I wasn't as fond of, and it didn't help that it was done in a fairly poor story. But just this idea that it's, you know, a skinwalker, and that it is something kind of, you know, a bit more related to the troubles than what we expected and stuff like that, and just the potential for an ongoing who's secretly the bad guy kind of story is just, it's, I dig it. I thought it was a really, really great way to present it. I'm looking forward to how they close out the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It took a lot of the problems from the previous episode and wiped them away, at least in my opinion.
Okay, well, definitely moved past it.
So that being the case, Bronston, what would you give it?
What would I give it? I'm... honestly, I may go as high as a 9.
Okay.
It was just it hit the balance. It was just it is everything that I really, really dig about this show. All, you know, firing all cylinders. It was a great episode.
How about you, Gary?
I'm going to give it an 8. It just it was good. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to criticize it, but when I start to hit 9 and 10, I needed a little bit more than this gave me.
Okay. I think I would give it a 9 myself. It was an episode. It was probably the episode this season that engaged me the most. So I definitely think that it deserves to have the highest score. And in fact, this one, JM, who has thankfully returned to reviewing and has been covering Haven for the last few episodes, gave this one a 10 because he felt very strongly that this was returning things back to the way that they could and should have been for quite some time now. So definitely one of the top episodes so far this season. So, okay, we are going to go ahead then. And, well, I think that we're going to wrap up this particular show with a little bit of a snark, to say the least. And that means, yes, it's time for us to cover the mid-season finale for Revolution. And, well, here's the promo.
Tom. My family. For your wife.
After being apart for so long.
Charlie.
Danny.
What will happen when they finally face off?
Come back. I'll let your family live.
With all the power now in his hands, he can finally unleash his entire arsenal.
Yes, he can unleash his entire arsenal in the last 20 seconds. All right. Edmund, could you please give us the recap here?
Absolutely. This is Revolution Season 1, Episode 10, Nobody's Fault But Mine. In the mid-season finale, Miles and Monroe finally come face-to-face, and Charlie encounters someone unexpected.
Really?
Heard a badass?
Yes, no, I think they mean Mom, but...
I'm going to dispute unexpected, but anyway. Yeah, this is them kind of, sort of bringing the story, quote-unquote, full circle, and cleaning up that first season arc, kind of. Yeah, it wasn't all that impressive.
Yeah.
I'll
give him credit for a couple of things. First off, I don't know if it's just because she was sharing so much of her screen time with Danny, and I think being on screen with Danny would make, Betty White look like a stone cold badass. But it seemed like Charlie had, finally took that level. And yeah. I mean she was a lot more with it this week, without being melodramatic about it. Like I was kind of with Danny in that moment where she just beats this guy, beats up this guard with a vent cover and takes his gun. And Charlie's just like, wait, Danny's just like, when did you become a kind of character that does stuff like that? So some credit there.
Well, it happened because clearly she's the only one who got even slightly the badass gene on her side of the family, because Danny certainly hasn't. I mean, he didn't really do a heck of a lot to help himself. But anyway, moving on.
And I'll also give credit to the two-part showdown between Miles and Monroe, not because of the writing so much as the actors, who I think did a good job of being serious and intense with material that wasn't as serious and intense as they thought it would be. And the sword fight was cool. So this episode had more positives than I typically find in an episode of Revolution.
Hmm.
But that's not to say it was particularly good.
Well, no. You were talking about the whole Miles and Monroe thing, but I wasn't quite expecting Monroe to be so needy of Miles. I mean, I know there was probably some sort of loss, but to almost practically be begging him back was a little bit of a twist that I didn't expect, and not that the writing, as you said, was amazing, but the concept of that I found interesting for them to play on a little bit.
I think they've been trying to set that up in this episode with all of the joint flashbacks and just kind of establishing that Monroe had lost his entire family shortly before the blackout, and then for the better part of 15 years, it had been him and Miles against the world. I can sort of get what they were trying to do. I'm not sure they did a particularly good job of establishing the emotion of that as well, and if it wasn't for the performance, it would have completely fallen apart.
Well, that's the problem, right? I mean, we know on one level that Monroe needed Miles to essentially help him do all of this stuff. I mean, he was kind of Monroe's badass for the longest time. But then we also know that, I don't know, Monroe is supposed to be this very imposing figure.
Mm-hmm.
But he hasn't been at all. I mean, he talks a good game, but I don't know that he's really done anything that impressive. Anyway, it's just part of the inconsistency that this show has been dealing with since forever. But anyhow, my biggest problem, other than the characterization, which continues to be a big whopping mess, is that ending. They play up in the promo, and they've been playing up for a while, that, oh, when he gets this power, he's going to be unstoppable, because, so many people have tried stopping him up to this point. But at any rate, great, now he has this power. What is he doing with it? He's chasing a bunch of people across the field? If in a realistic situation, do they have any chance of surviving? No. So it seems like this really goofy thing, because there's no way that they're going to make it through this. Or they shouldn't.
Yeah.
So
except they totally will.
Yes.
Except they will, because they will make it to the woods just in time. And anyway,
how did that
bullets,
engine not
bullets
even smoke
go through
when,
trees.
When that helicopter started? How the heck did that thing that engine even move? That thing had to be locked up beyond bullets.
Right. Well, that's a different problem.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and you only have a half mile limit. I mean, you basically have this magic crate of an amplifier that basically has to stay within, you know, the center of every operation you do. And if anything mm-hmm. happens to it, which, oh, I'm sure something will at some point, you know, you're turned off again.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not even quite a Pandora's box so much as an Achilles heel to a large extent, because all somebody has to do is grab the necklace out of it and it's over with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which does bring up the one huge plot hole of after Mom gets away and she's all alone in that lab and doesn't grab the necklace, but anyway.
Right, well, yeah.
I know! What the goddamn hell?
But
the
yeah, but, I mean, makes sense, I, really.
Yeah, but that was the thing where, I mean, there were just so many moments, I mean, you know, just little things that got to me was, you know, like apparently the Monroe Militia's method of fighting is your leader stands behind and lets the guys around him do all the shooting.
Yes, well, because Miles was the only one who knew how to do anything, see?
It all and of course I practically yelled at the TV when the upshot of the Neville standoff is to stuff them in the closet, and it's like, no, he's the most interesting character, take him
along. Well, he did have he did have the "I will kill you for this," you know, what, for locking you in a closet? Yeah.
You don't take the most you don't take the best actor on the show and lock them in a closet for half the episode. Yeah. That's dumb. That really should be in a book somewhere about
writing
stuff you don't do.
Wasn't that in Stephen King's book on writing? Like, don't stuff Neville in a closet.
don't stuff Giancarlo Esposito in a closet.
That's it. You only put Hitler in the closet. You do not put one.
Right. Okay. I thought that was maybe you didn't put in the closet.
That's a corner. That's very different.
Yeah.
I thought you don't put babies in the blender. Oh, that's a different book. Sorry.
Yes. We're getting way off note here.
I think it's Gremlins in the blender. But
yes, of course. But no, this episode, I mean, it was just, it basically was the capstone, just not in the way that they want it to be. It was the capstone to everything that's been kind of a complaint that we've had. It has potential still. This could have all culminated very well, but the way that they did it was just so ham-fisted and lazy. That
after half a season's worth of complaints, we've reached the complaint climax.
Yes. we've reached the conclusion that the complaints are just not going to get any more complainy than they already have been. And that's now a technical term. All right, well, I mean, what would we give this? Certainly nothing good, but what would you give it, Bronze Thumb?
For the cool sword fight and for Charlie taking a teaspoon of concrete again, I'd go a 6.
Mm.
That's right, I found positives about the episode, so we're going with a 6. That's Revolution for you.
How about you, Gary?
I think a 6 was too generous. It wasn't absolutely horrible, and by no means was it good. I'm going to split it right down the middle at a 5. It was watchable, but I regretted it afterwards.
Edmund, did you have your regrets?
Most definitely. No, I'm right with Gary at a 5. I mean, a couple of minor redeeming things, but way too many other things that were just tough to stomach.
Yeah.
Sounds like the McDonald's television.
Yeah, I'm still going with a 5 as well. Sorry, Bronze Thumb, you're the one out on the limb. Although Henry also gave it a 6, so...
Yeah.
I believe Henry... No, I think that's JM again doing the reviews for Revolution. But anyway, regardless, this show is definitely not hitting what we want it to hit. And after 10 episodes, the average is 5.8. Let's compare that a little bit to The Walking Dead, and where that's at halfway through the season, 8.6. So almost 3 entire points less. I don't know that we can get any more distinct than that, other than to say, hey, it's not Bedlam.
That's
anyway.
True.
Yes, well...
Thankfully, nothing's Bedlam.
Yeah, exactly.
Except possibly Bedlam Series 2.
Which, thankfully...
It does not exist in my world.
That's right.
I call the Highlander corollary into
the Highlander corollary. I like that. That should also be in a book.
Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter @CriticalMyth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
you can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that critical misuse of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time.
What can I say? Hasn't been a night like this since the walls were completed. And I thought we were past it. Past the days when we all sat huddled, scared in front of the TV during the early days of the outbreak. The fear we all felt then, we felt it again tonight. I failed you. I promise to keep you safe. Hell, look at me. You know, I should tell you that we'll be okay. That we're safe. And tomorrow we'll bury our dead and endure, but I won't. Because I can't. Because I'm afraid. That's right. I'm afraid of terrorists who want what we have. Want to destroy us. Worse. Because one of those terrorists is one of our own. Merle! Man, I counted on. Man, I trust. He led him here. He let him in. You, you lied, betrayed us all. This is one of the terrorists.